London, about medicine, about the theatre. And what he extraordinarily does is he says, you know, I had to imagine myself a Tibetan and think what would strike a Tibetan. And so he's trying to write from a Tibetan point of view, which I think is an extraordinary act of imaginative identification.
Bogle was a product of a Scottish liberal education in the 18th century. He was open-minded and curious. He was also interested in religions of the world. He understood that Christianity was only one of many expressions of human religiosity. So he talked in very fair-minded terms about Tibetan Buddhism. He thought that the Tibetan way of life, their way of marrying, their way of burying people, had just as much integrity as in Scottish and English and European ways of doing things. This was a remarkable example of tolerant, open-minded, enlightened European thinking about other cultures in the world.
He's very struck by some of the conceptions of the divinity and the grandeur of divinity as well. And at some moments, he certainly says, you know, poor benighted Europeans, we don't have this sort of exalted conception of the divine.
Bogle was operating in a remarkable window in time between narrow Scottish Presbyterianism and later missionary zeal. As he crossed the mountain passes into Bhutan under the guidance of the Hindu trading monk Purangir, his perspectives began to change. As the ambassador of the governor, he was in a grander position than he was used to, and yet he was also more dependent than ever before, completely reliant on Purangir, to whom this wasn't some great first in exploration, but a routine journey. Bogle's informal letters to his sisters capture some of this strange new world.
This is one to his, I think, his favourite sister, Annie. And then he sort of impersonates his sister. But where have you got to, George, with your valleys and your boots? And it's a hard question, but I think with my father's assistance and Matty's knowledge in geography, you may be able to conjure within 40 or 50 miles whereabouts I am. So there he's remembering their sort of childhood together, and he's saying, you know, I'm in the middle of nowhere. And this is this wonderful moment where he's come all the way. He's been received with great formality by the Debraja of Bhutan. And what you have here is this wonderful little diagram which shows the audience chamber in which he was received. And so you've got little entries here that say things like idols, and Dhiraja, the Debraja, mirrors and pillars, and me. And he discovers this print of Lady Waldegrave, who's a society beauty, this London society beauty, being displayed as a kind of curiosity in the reception chamber. So this is an extraordinary moment where you see this very long reach of British trade.
In Bogle's case, it reached back to the Clyde, and then over to the other side of the world, to his family's West Indian plantations. Maritime historian Dr. Eric Graham met me at their home estate. So we're at Dundowie, and this is actually quite a magical place. It's now a crematorium, and we're in a garden set aside from the crematorium, a very big field full of trees, and underneath each tree is a different shrine. This tree is covered in wind chimes and dream catchers. It's very sweet. It's to a lady who died 5 years ago, and the flowers are still fresh. People have just been here. George Bogle, what did this mean to him, this place?
Well, this is his family seat, and this is becomes the raison d'etre, the reason for being as a young adventurer, to secure your family's fortunes. Everything is to do with land. This is the only known security in Georgian England, is to own your land. Everything else can be taken from you.
So this is hugely important to George, isn't it?
And more than that, he's a saviour of Dundowie for the family. In 1772, the London house of Bogle and Scott get in extreme difficulties. So there's a crisis, and the Bogles could have lost Dundowie. But the young George sends back something in excess of £4,500.
Wow. What does that in today's money? What do we multiply it by?
Well, roughly about 100 times.
Gosh.
So he's
so millions.
Something around about 4 million he sent back in today's terms.
Wow.
And he's not even in his early 30s. Now, this is what can be done in India if you're in the right position. And he makes most of his money after the Tibetan trip, when he is given as a reward for his endeavours in Tibet. He's given the collector of revenue position at Rangpur. And there, he can seriously charge the local traders for the privilege.
When we're reading George's letters, it's impossible not to warm to him. He comes across as a genuinely engaging person, a genuinely interested person. This surely can't all be an illusion.
No, you find other Scots, say, like other frontiers, like Canada, you know, with the First Nations, and they are amiable and they're very interested in the Indigenous cultures, in their pursuit of business. But at the end of the day, it's business.
George Bogle managed to save Daldowie, but he never saw it again. He died young in Calcutta in 1781, and the Panchen Lama actually expired on the very trip to China where Bogle and Hastings hoped he'd plead their cause. The trade never materialised, but did something else come out of the mission? George sent more than money back to Daldowie. He also sent two little girls, Martha and Mary. Britain's first and last permanent representative in Tibet, the eminent scholar Hugh Richardson, was astonished and intrigued when one of Bogle's descendants told him the girl's mother was Tibetan.
And Richardson was struck by the fact that in the genealogy, the alleged Tibetan wife was called Tikhan, which Richardson said could not have been invented, because these records stem from the middle of the 19th century when very few Scottish people had knowledge of Tibet. And for Richardson, that was an authentic clue that there must have been something in the family that led them to have an actual Tibetan name for this woman. And after very careful, meticulous research, Richardson concluded that Bogle had married a young 19-year-old niece of the Panchen Lama.
One of the few things that we do know is that Bogle was suffering from a venereal complaint that probably had been contracted at some stage while he was in Bhutan and Tibet, and because he writes talking about the need for mercurial ointment. So there probably has been some sort of sexual relation at some stage. Certainly could have been before. It could be during his mission. He also takes particular notice, and he writes to his sisters, about two nieces of the Panchen Lama. One niece is not very well favoured, but the other one is as ruddy as a milkmaid, and they're both very merry, and they enjoy each other's company. It's not entirely clear what his relations are with these nieces. At times they visit each other, they might become quite flirtatious, and there's a lot of fun and merriment.
Richardson's correspondent was Nora Heathcote, a descendant of George. She had known Martha's granddaughters, who had told her wonderful stories of the girl's life at Daldowie, involving governesses, coaches, dressing up, and a doomed engagement to the young son of a neighbouring family. They believed their great-grandmother, Tichan, was a sister of the Panchen Lama. Other families close to the Bogles confirmed the tradition.
The more you look into it, the more problematic the Hugh Richardson solution becomes. After Bogle came back from Tibet, he mixed with his friends for about 6 or 7 years before he eventually died in 1781. All these men had women in Calcutta, and it was common in the letters to make references to who these women were. There is no reference for 6 years in any of the letters of Bogle's friends to a Tibetan wife. The second problem is that when Bogle died, his estate in Bengal was settled by his closest friend in Bengal, David Anderson, and Claude Alexander. And they had to figure out what to do with Bogle's money, what to do with Bogle's children. And they make no mention of a Tibetan wife. And then Warren Hastings actually visited Daldowie House. So here we have the former Governor General of India, who had sent Bogle on a Tibet mission, which was crucial for his plans for opening up the China market. You would think in Hastings' papers there'd be some reference to the special connection that Bogle had made with Tibet through this marriage. But there's silence.
Silence, too, in Bogle's papers. But then they were judiciously arranged in 1876, before a remaining family would allow an editor access to them. attitudes to children of mixed race had hardened since George's day, and it's possible any reference to the children's mother was excised. Some fragments concerning George's private life survived the cull, but they referred to a distinctly non-high-ranking mistress on a 20-rupee-a-month pension. Other scraps of evidence seem to rule out the possibility that the girl's mother was one of the Lama's nieces.
After Bogle's return to Calcutta, he is sending presents up to the pension Lama. And among those presents that he's sending are presents for the nieces. He sends lorries, which are these very colourful parrots. So he's sending them gifts. So certainly the pension Lama's nieces didn't accompany him back down to Calcutta.
And finally, for me, it was a mixed moment for me in the British Library. On the one hand, great excitement that I discovered a letter which seemed to finally shed light on this mystery. On the other hand, disappointment, because I did want the Richardson story to be true. This was a letter written by George Bogle to his closest friend, David Anderson. And Bogle says to Anderson, "I'm really looking forward to you coming down to Calcutta. We're going to have great fun together. We'll go," and this is a quote, "we'll go every night to visit the ladies." So here's evidence from 1776, 2 years after the Tibet mission, that George Bogle was not in a monogamous relationship with any woman. He, like all the other young men in the company service, had several sexual liaisons in Bengal, often resulting in children, and that these children were more likely the result of these relationships in Calcutta. Louise, I really wanted that story to be true, and it was, in many ways, a bleak moment for me in the archives when I discovered that letter, which cast at least some doubt on it.
During research for the programme, our producer found Martha's record of burial. It put her age at 70 in 1843. If accurate, that would make her too old to be the product of the Tibet mission of 1774. The likelihood is that Martha and her sister Mary were the result of a much less romantic liaison. European men in India kept harems of women who could be maintained, shared, and or casually discarded. The children who resulted were the property of the men, and sometimes, if they were white enough, girls would be sent back to their father's home country.
Notice they always send girls, not boys.
Yeah, why always girls?
Girls can be married into other families without the worry about inheritable property. Sons may have a claim.
So this pragmatism goes even this far. So what happens to the little boys?
They don't come. In the West Indies situation, they don't send boys. They're left as household servants within the plantation system. And in India, whereas the girls are marketable, you can market them up to be married into at least a decent promoted marriage. So if you notice how they handle the dowries, while the two girls are given large dowries from the father's estate, about £4,000 each, there's no property. That is not theirs to have. They are mixed race children.
So it comes back again to this place, this estate.
Yes.
This must be kept intact.
Yes.
Despite George Bogle's receptiveness to other cultures, he was still a man of his time, engaged in the casual sexual exploitation of Indian women. Empire came at an unimaginable cost to these individuals. Martha and Mary's story catches our eye because it's so unusual. But behind it lies a blend of patriarchal responsibility and casual callousness that's as disturbing now as it was humdrum in its day. But if the story isn't true, where did it come from? Gordon Stewart thinks it may have originated with Bogle himself.
I am a romantic at heart. I wanted it to be true. As you could tell, I'm Scottish. I wanted this first Scottish person to have entered Tibet, who already had very enlightened and decent and admirable views on Tibet. I wanted that story to be completed by this happy marriage. My hypothesis is that these children, which Bogle fathered in Calcutta, when they were sent home to Daldowey in Scotland, that Bogle conveyed the impression to his sisters that these children were from a Tibetan wife. In other words, he wanted to connect these children with the important mission that he'd made to Tibet in 1774, in which he always referred to for the rest of his life as the most wonderful moment in his life. And rather than telling his family that he, like all the other young men, was having children by ordinary women in Calcutta, he wanted to convince his family that the children were the result of this important mission to Tibet.
Was George motivated to romanticise his daughter's origins in the hope of releasing them from social stigma? Their hefty dowries didn't result in marriages to the landed classes. Martha married a clerk and Mary a manufacturer. Ironically, many of their children would plunge back into the empire.
And quite often they move on to Australia, where having capital and good connection works marvellously well. And this is exactly what happens with Martha's and at least one of Mary's children. They move on to Australia, leaving the property to the rightful heirs, who are your indigenous Scottish wife-produced children.
Tibet on the Banks of the Clyde was presented by Louise Welsh and produced in Edinburgh by Louise Yeoman. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Handage. The second part of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra's 75th anniversary celebration, in which the orchestra's being conducted by Martin Brabbins. So far, if I can fight against the promenader's announcements, they've recreated the programme of the orchestra's very first proms appearance back in 1962. And they end this evening with the same work they did then, Tchaikovsky's Little Russian Symphony. £47,000 so far this year the promenaders have collected for musical charities. But first, we come up to date. In 1962, the orchestra played a new work by Thea Musgrave, her Shakespeare setting The Phoenix and the Turtle. Tonight, it's the UK premiere of La Navette by the Scottish composer James Dillon, who's celebrating his 60th birthday this year. Its title means shuttle, as used in the process of weaving, and it's a cross-reference to another work Dillon was writing at the same time, his music theatre piece, Philomela. James Dillon.
The obvious connection is the metaphor of weaving itself. And of course, this is a common metaphor, is used often as an analogy for composing itself, the act of composing. And so there is no musical connection between Philomela and La Navette. It's just actually a kind of a phase I was going through, something that was obsessing me at that time. I was also beginning to study Anatolian Kellynes and the way that, for example, the nomadic tribes in central Turkey are often improvising. They have standard symbolic patterns, of course, that they work with, but often they run out of certain kinds of coloured dyed threads or whatever, and they'll replace it. And I became fascinated with the act of weaving itself and what that means for the compositional process.
Your music is clearly appreciated round Europe, whereas a lot of contemporary composers' careers are distinctly national.
Mm-hmm. I think if you go right back to the beginning of my being performed, it's clear that my references were definitely not national. And the composers that I grew up with were composers like Stockhausen, and particularly Xenakis, Varese. Really, you know, if Schoenberg, you know, liberates the tone and Stravinsky liberates rhythm, then Varese liberates noise. And I was fascinated, I've always been fascinated with the aspect of noise itself in the finer nuances of timbre. My references were very much not the kind of obsessions that seem to be peculiar to Britain in particular.
James Dillon. Well, as Ovid tells Philomela's story, she was raped by Tereus, her sister Procne's husband and king of Thrace. And to prevent Philomela from telling of his crime, Tereus cuts out her tongue. Well, she may be silenced and abandoned, but she's able to tell what happened by weaving it into a cloth with the shuttle. A cloth which is then delivered to Tereus. And when Procne discovers the truth, she kills her son and feeds him to Tereus as punishment. The gods intervene in the cycle of revenge and turn the three protagonists into birds. Philomela's voice is restored as a nightingale. So now here once again is Martin Brabbins, the conductor of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, in the UK premiere of James Dillon's La Navette. That was the UK premiere of James Thillen's La Navette, performed here in the Royal Albert Hall and live on Radio 3 by the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Martin Bravins. Tim Rutherford-Johns writes in tonight's programme note, the Latin word for weaving is texare, from which we get both text and textile. To weave is to tell a story, and as Philomela knew, it's only in the completion of the cloth that its potential is revealed. Martin Bravins, absolutely calm in the midst of that extremely complex writing, every string section in multi-layers. And here comes James Thillen. He says a concert's like stepping inside a magic circle. Huge embrace between Bravins and Thillen. Thillen shaking. The leader's hand and taking a bow. If you want to hear more Thillen tonight, there's a composer portrait recorded early this evening at the Royal College of Music Musicians from the Royal Scottish Academy of Music and Drama. That's at 10:30. James Thillen's got a world premiere for his 60th birthday in November. Nine Rivers, it's called. Electroacoustic piece. It lasts 3 hours. 36 musicians, 16 singers, 6 percussion, plus electronics. On a lighter note, he says he's writing a 6-minute orchestral work for the Basque National Orchestra. It's a challenge to keep it that short. And he's finishing his 6th string quartet for the Donaueschingen Festival. Well, now it's back to that very first BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra proms night in 1962, when they ended their concert with Tchaikovsky's 2nd Symphony, known as the Little Russian. It's a pretty misleading name, which the symphony was given because at the time it was written, the 1870s, the rather demeaning name for the Ukraine was Little Russia. Tchaikovsky often used to spend part of the summer with his sister and her husband at Kamenka in the Ukraine, and one day when he was orchestrating his opera Undina, a carpenter working in the next room started singing a song called Vanya Sat on the Divan. Tchaikovsky used it for his first string quartet, and his particular interest in Ukrainian folk music took off. 3 years later, he was back at Kamenka when he began work on his 2nd symphony. An ideal venue, given the folk material he used in the piece. What he does with it, the way he colours it, it's one of the most intoxicating things about this symphony, which Tchaikovsky manages to mix Russian and European tendencies, and with them transform and improve his symphonic style. On Boxing Day 1872, Tchaikovsky went to a party at the Rimsky-Korsakov's, taking his new symphony with him. He played its finale to the guests, who included the so-called mighty handful of composers led by Rimsky-Korsakov and Balakirev. They greatly admired the new work for its use of folk music. As Tchaikovsky reported, the assembled company could almost have torn me to pieces in their delight, and Madame Korsakova begged me with tears in her eyes for an arrangement for piano duet. The premiere of the full work was also a huge success. Each of the 4 movements contains folk tunes. The whole feel of the piece is less like his usually emotionally charged symphonies, more akin to his later ballet scores. And the second movement is actually the first of Tchaikovsky's symphonic marches, based on a wedding march from his now discarded opera Undina and interwoven with a Ukrainian folk song. The finale begins with a mock portentous introduction for a kind of set of variations on, or perhaps better, coloured backgrounds to the folk song The Crane. It's delightful and quixotically folkloric. No wonder the mighty handful were so enthused, as, by the way, was Igor Stravinsky. So now, here once again comes Martin Bravins onto the platform here in the Royal Albert Hall, joining the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra to conduct Tchaikovsky's 2nd symphony, The Little Russian.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, the mighty handful of Russian composers gathered at the Rimsky-Korsakovs were delighted by Tchaikovsky playing his symphony for them at the piano, and the rather larger audience here in the Royal Albert Hall clearly very enthusiastic at that orchestral performance of Tchaikovsky's second symphony, The Little Russian, given to end their 75th birthday concert by the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, guest leader Janice Graham, conducted by Martin Brabbins. Tchaikovsky without the neuroses, you might say. Well, the BBC Scottish returns to the Royal Albert Hall for tomorrow's late-night prom. Ilan Volkov conducts a magnificent bouquet of four experimental pieces from Britain and America by Cage, Cardew, Skempton and Morton Feldman. His piano and orchestra, in which the soloist will be John Tilbury. Cellist, Anthony Sayer.
This is what we do well, this sort of programme, with Ilan Volkov as well. And it's a great programme. It's a mixed bag, some very accessible music in it. And it's what we do well. Yes, it won't get a full house, and we wouldn't expect it, but we get a very appreciative audience here at the Proms, a unique audience for modern music. Tomorrow night is good fun.
And in the 7 o'clock start, Arvo Pärt's first symphony for 35 years, his fourth, gets its UK premiere from the Philharmonia and Esa-Pekka Salonen. In this week of Scriabin, there's more, The Poem of Ecstasy and Ravel's Left-Hand Piano Concerto. But for now, time to leave the Royal Albert Hall and for me to hand you on to Jonathan Swain in Broadcasting House to host the rest of your Radio 3 evening.
Martin, thank you. Martin Handley there at the Royal Albert Hall. And just to say, there's another chance to hear tonight's prom broadcast again here on BBC Radio 3 on Friday afternoon of next week. That's the 27th of August at 2:20. Also, if you'd like to submit a review of tonight's prom, then just go to bbc.co.uk/proms and click on share.
On Breakfast each morning through the summer prom season, we'll be bringing you the Henry Wood Proms Novelties, pieces of music that Sir Henry Wood introduced to proms audiences for the very first time, going right the way back to the first season in 1895. There are lost gems and works that have become great classics over time. The Henry Wood Novelties in Breakfast on Radio 3 every morning from 7.
Well, right now on Radio 3, after the premiere of composer James Dillon's piece La Navette in tonight's prom, James talks to Andrew McGregor in the third of this year's Proms Composer Portraits.
Welcome to this Proms Composer Portrait, where we're about to meet James Dillon and hear some of his chamber music and piano pieces performed by musicians from the Royal Scottish Academy of Music and Drama in Glasgow, members of the Academy's Music Lab, its crack team of contemporary music enthusiasts, led by the Academy's conducting fellow Jessica Cottis. Now, James, the first work we're going to hear takes us back to the early 80s.
Zone de Azul, yeah.
De Azul. So there's a Spanish subtext in some
yeah,
sense.
Yeah, in 71 I met Robert Graves, the poet, at Idris Shah's house in Kent. And I hadn't seen him a long time, and I went to visit him. I heard he was sick in Deya. And it's one of the few occasions when I wrote a piece inspired by the landscape itself. It's not something that is common to my practice, shall we say. And so the origins of Zone was this Mallorcan summer I spent in Deia with Robert Graves.
And it seems to shimmer somehow. A lot of tremolos, a lot of glissandi, lots of swift time
the title
changes.
Itself,
it seems to give off heat almost.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I hadn't really thought of that. The title itself actually came from a poem by Jorge Luis Borges, and he's really talking about the Milky Way. And actually, my abiding memory in Deia was the skies, the night skies. And there was one night when actually there was an arc of blue. It was the Milky Way just crossing the Mediterranean. It was just something, kind of the image stuck with me. And so I kind of began to imagine what it might mean for a musical texture. But as I said, I mean, it's not... it's definitely not program music, of course, but it's definitely something that's unusual for me to respond so directly and try to kind of capture something.
Well, let's hear it for ourselves. To perform James Dillon's Zone de Azul, please welcome our musicians from the Royal Scottish Academy's Music Lab and conductor Jessica Cottis.
Thank you.
Zone de Azul, which I suppose we could translate as the Blue Zone?
Zone of Blue.
Zone of Blue, by James Dillon, performed by members of Music Lab from the Royal Scottish Academy in the city of James's birth, Glasgow. Clarinetist Fraser Langton, horn player David Smith, trumpeter Brian Allen, trombonist Davo Juel Magnusson, pianist Ed Cohen, violinist Willem Matlener, viola player Emma Peebles, and cellist Duncan Strachan, conducted by Jessica Cottis, who's actually Donald Runicle's assistant at the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra. James, there's so many tiny changes of rhythm and pulse and time signature bar by bar. It really is massively complex for the players and the conductor to get their head around, and yet you generate this sense of fluidity, a sort of timeless flow. This sort of contrast between the detail and the overall effect seems to be something that's quite important to you.
Yeah, whenever I'm asked about who I studied with, I always say that the only teacher is nature in the end. And it seems to me that, I'm kind of responding to a certain kind of complexity in the world, and it's very nuanced. I'm interested in the smallest musical transition, the musical nuance itself. It's the kind of, it's the difference between, let's say, the way that Glenn Gould will take a note and the way that Andras Schiff will take a note, or the way that Muddy Waters will bend a note and the way that John Williams will not bend a note. It's kind of the characteristics of playing itself fascinate me. The fact that the smallest transition can actually have the largest effect, the most expressive effect. So I've often tried to somehow, how does one weave that kind of microscopic information into a larger architecture is the battle. And of course, whilst there's a lot of disruptive elements in the music, I'm kind of almost aiming for something that feels natural.
And are you actually looking for specific patterns, things that you can use to generate your own patterns in the music, or is it a more of an instinctive and reactive kind of?
Well, it's always a rich mixture between something that's highly measured and something that's much more instinctive and intuitive. And if the measurements don't make any sense to me, then I change them. And I might change them by hand, or I might recalculate things. But it's always, for me, it's a kind of interweaving of something that has a certain kind of precision and measure to it, and something that is much more chaotic and much more unpredictable, and something that's kind of, I'd let my nose lead me through it.
Now, you mentioned a couple of very different guitarists back there. You were a guitarist yourself, weren't you? Take us back to the 1960s when you were playing in a rock band down in Cornwall. And what was it that actually turned you onto classical music? What were the sounds you heard that first pulled you in that direction?
Well, first of all, it wasn't called a rock band at that time. rock was a term that was in. They dropped the and roll part of it. I used to know something called rock and roll, but when I was involved in something what was called rhythm and blues music, it was kind of it's the kind of thing that Rolling Stones, the Pretty Things, the Yardbirds were doing. But I lost interest in it when I was 18. I could see somehow that it began to become incredibly decadent, important, and it didn't interest me. And by accident, I didn't know which direction to go in, but I was also I was struggling with the musicians I was working with at the time. I was beginning to put ideas to them that they were misinterpreting. They thought I was moving in the direction of progressive rock, which was, for me, it was like moving towards the devil. And so I by accident discovered Webern and Stravinsky, and I began to investigate this kind of music, and it was completely new to me. I didn't know anything in the 20th century beyond Rachmaninoff. That was as far as the 20th century was concerned.
Can you remember the effect those sounds had on you? Because if you have no preparation for those musical worlds.
I was completely astonished by it. I didn't understand Webern. It was the Five Bagatelles, string quartet. And it just seemed like this is the craziest music I've ever heard in my life. And I wanted to know why, where it had come from, and why someone could strip something to its kind of the essence of gesture. And it began to fascinate me. I discovered very quickly Xenakis and Stockhausen, and they were really the important turning point for me, because then I could see it was music that was being written today, and it was about ideas, and I found very, very attractive.
And what about the complexity of people like, some Stockhausen, obviously, and Xenakis, mm-hmm. Particularly? Was that something you automatically found attractive, the level of detail that...
The level of detail, for sure. The complexity is a sort of, you know, it's become such a loaded term, yeah. And one that I've, you know, spent 25 years trying to divorce myself from, in the sense that it's because it was, I think, too associated with the look of the score more than anything else. I think all music is complex. I, like I said earlier, began to become interested in the small nuances, which took me into a territory of kind of microscopic territory, which meant that sometimes I was trying to organize things that previously would be seen as the player's business, because I was fascinated by the difference that it made. And I think that comes out of my fascination with the act of interpretation. The score, what differentiates the Western classical tradition is the score from all other classical traditions, the Indian tradition or the Japanese Gagaku tradition or this written tradition, the thing that Plato, of course, was objecting to. And so the score enables one to move into a territory which is unimaginable on a more spontaneous level. You can imagine how to organize things at a very, very small level.
Let's talk about the way you've organized things in the two piano pieces we're going to hear next, because they're both much more recent, written in the last couple of years. I was curious about the titles, because Charm and Dragonfly, they both seem as though they have quite specific extra musical inspiration, perhaps. And are they both for birthdays?
Yeah, they were very, very quickly written. I think Charm was written in a day and a half, and Dragonfly in, well, less than a week for sure.
And Charm, is this Charm as in Bewitch or Charm as in Bracelet? Or
yeah, I'm leaving it kind of open because, of course, Charm is also, is a fundamental particle in high-energy nuclear physics. And, you know, I spent part of the 70s subsidizing my own compositional studies by working at Imperial College across just down the road here. And it was just at the time of the beginning of the CERN project. So I became fascinated by that whole, you know, this quest for finding the essence of life, Charm was one of the names they gave to one of the fundamental particles at this time while I was there. They discovered the quark while I was there.
So talking about the essence of life, if we're talking about the birth of a child as well.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, for anybody who was working, and I was just working as a lab technician, you know, I wasn't a physicist, obviously. It was amongst the lab technicians, it was a big joke, the idea of looking for the essence of life. Still is a big joke.
What about Dragonfly? Is there anything literally depicting the insect here? Or?
Yeah, and it's something, for sure it was actually based upon the observation of dragonflies. I moved to Minneapolis 3 years ago, and in spring, these things come out of everywhere. And I was kind of curious about the nervioso quality of their flight. And so I was trying to capture a little of that, if you like. But it was written for a lady who got sick and was a close friend of mine. And she was a great gardener. And she would talk a lot about it. So it was a personal thing.
Well, let's hear them both. To perform James Dillon's piano pieces, Charm and Dragonfly, please welcome back pianist Ed Cohen.
Thank you.
dragonfly capturing some of the iridescence and lightning-fast movements of the insect in music by James Dillon. And before it, we heard Charm, played for us by Ed Cohen from the Royal Scottish Academy of Music and Drama's Music Lab. And James, after hearing those pieces, with Dragonfly, it sounds as though you have something which gives you a level of control, parameters within which to write. But every time you start a musical journey, every time you begin a piece, the possibilities are limitless. How do you define the landscape or soundscape or the boundaries within which you're going to create a piece?
It varies from piece to piece. I mean, I have different strategies. One of the things that I try to do is not repeat myself. So that's a kind of already certain, it creates certain boundaries. By repeat, I'm talking about, my own recent past. One of the things that I never calculated for was that I would build up a body of work which actually then I become self-conscious about. It could come from a title, it could come from, but it's usually something small that I begin to build up a set of, I look for a way that I can spin outwards from the initial idea. In other words, what kind of connections can I make? Every piece for me is a kind of Indra's net in a way. Things are interconnected in different ways, and sometimes they can be loosely connected initially. I can take two ideas which are initially unrelated. Part of the ludic quality of working is actually finding ways to connect them. And that produces something else, which takes me in another direction. So sometimes some pieces are kind of very organic like that. Other times I have a very strict form scheme. For example, when I was working during most of the 80s on Nine Rivers, I was working to a very close form scheme, but that was where my head was at that time. I was very much interested in musical architecture.
But Nine Rivers is an interesting case in point, because that's absolutely off the scale in the other direction, isn't it? These are pieces which you've been writing, orchestral works and involving some electronics, which have taken you the best part of 20 years, finished in 1999, I think. Mm-hmm. And there have been individual performances of the individual.